Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 5th of June 2026 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's been a 3-year break since the last episode of Patriotic History. I have to apologise for that, but I am back today with a new episode and I also have a new co-host. The two previous co-hosts, Patriarch and Truthvids, are now both busy raising families, which is certainly good news, but it means that they don't have enough time to record podcasts. So I've had to find another co-host and it's taken me a while, but I think I've found a suitable co-host. He's the publisher of Armoreg Books. That's Germar Rudolph's books. He publishes them in Britain under armoreg.co.uk and he has quite an interest in history. So I'm hoping that he's going to be a good co-host. He's been on previous podcasts with Paul English. You might have heard him there. His name is Jeff Roberts and I'm going to introduce him now and say hello, Jeff. Thank you very much for coming on today. And how are you doing? How is life treating you?
Hello, Sven. Yeah, everything is fine. Actually, I had some very good news last week, which I can't tell you, but it's a fantastic news for us at Armoreg. Yeah, I'm fine, and I'm looking forward to doing things now. I'm full of confidence, and as I said, this event that happened last week is gave me more incentive for the future.
Are we gonna get to hear about that then, or is that got to be kept secret?
Well, for the moment, it's going to be kept secret, but you'll eventually hear about it, I expect.
Okay, so we can share in the enthusiasm. As I say, people can go to armoreg.co.uk and they can check out Germar Rudolph's books. His whole library is there and you can purchase the hard copies. And Jeff is the man that manages it. And we're going to get straight back into where we finished off last time, actually. And we were using Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, Book 2. And we just got to the death of Edward the Confessor and what was happening after that. And we were basically going through the Bayeux Tapestry, which is actually coming to Britain in September. The Bayeux Tapestry is coming to the British Museum. It's the first time that it's left France for 900 years. And this tapestry effectively tells the story of William the Conqueror, or William the Norman, or William the Bastard, whichever name you prefer. William was a bastard. He was the illegitimate son of his father's mistress. And yet he was the king of Normandy. He also fought in battles in order to keep his place as the king of Normandy. He was a battle-weary warrior, quite a man by all accounts. Do you want to just make any comments on William the Conqueror before we begin getting into these notes, Jeff, or any background to the story of the Bayeux Tapestry?
It's a fascinating story. It's very interesting. And the Normans, or should we call them Norsemen, were Vikings who had settled in France and had adopted French as a language. And their influence on Britain was incredible and amazing. They virtually doubled our language. We have in English 500,000 words, and that's because we're speaking French and German. Amalgamation of those. Well, a German has got, say, 150,000 words, while English, or English Normanish, we should say, has got over 500,000 words. You know, their development and their exertions was absolutely incredible, amazing. You know, I went on holiday to Ireland relatively recently, and the amount of castles over there built by the Normans is just enormous. Everything is amazing about the Normans, but they're so downplayed as they have, as an ethnic group, they virtually disappeared in England now. So,
well, it's good to hear a positive appraisal of them. I mean, as we've been going through this history series, we've been talking about things from the Welsh point of view, the ancient Britons' point of view, and then we talked about it from the Saxons' point of view when we got to the Saxons, and now we're really going to be talking about it from the Norman point of view, as I say, as we get into this Bayeux Tapestry. And there is still some negative feelings towards the Normans and the way that they replace the Anglo-Saxons, as I say. So it is good to hear from somebody that is impressed with the Normans. As I say, their castle building is quite amazing. We have lots of them in Wales. So let's get on with our notes here. We'll continue where we left off. Quotes are taken from Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, Book 2. The events which follow are peculiarly interesting to us. William, in complete armour, extends one hand to Harold's right temple. His other is upon Harold's right arm and breast. Harold is a little inclining towards him and supports a lance with a banner in his left hand. And the words above are, "Here, William, give alms to Harold." A Norman historian mentions that William rewarded the exertions of Harold with a splendid arms, horses, and other insignia. After three horsemen in armour with the letters "Here William comes to Bagius," that's Bayo, William appears without armour on his throne with a sword, his left hand extended. Near this are two repositories of relics. Harold is between them with a hand on each. Officers are at both ends. The inscription is, "Here Harold swears to Duke William." The historians state that Harold swore to promote William's accession to the throne of England on Edmund's demise, to marry his daughter, and to put Dover into his power. Some other authorities mention that William, after Harold had sworn, uncovered the repositories and showed him on what relics he had pledged himself, and Harold saw with alarm their number and importance. If this be true, these two great warriors were, at least in their religion, men of petty minds, or they would not have believed that the obligation of an oath was governed by the rules of arithmetical progression. And it really does show us the importance that was placed upon these relics. And you really don't want to break an oath that you had promised on them, because you were just asking for the punishment, I guess, really, from these saints. And this oath was... because William was supposedly, this is the Norman story, is that William was promised that he would have the kingship of London, of England rather, and he was promised this, and yet on his deathbed, Edmund on his deathbed, apparently, he then said to Harold Godwinson that he wanted him to actually be king. So this was at the root of this quarrel, effectively. And then when he died, Harold Godwinson, he announced that he was king. He pronounced himself king, effectively. And then William heard about this in Normandy, and he believed that he had the right to be king because Edmund had promised it to him. And that was basically the backstory to this. And that's what the bio tapestry is showing there. Any comments on this, Jeff?
Well, it's very interesting you said that, because what happens here is an oath has been taken, but oaths should be freely given and freely made. But here it seems like Harold was the victim of a trick, that he pledged himself and then the relics were uncovered, which showed that he actually pledged himself as a sworn sort of statement. So whether that counts as an oath, it does, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, they are actually supposed to be freely given. And obviously in this case, it does sound like Harold was tricked into making this pledge.
Well, that's interesting, because, I mean, that's actually showing it there on the Bayeux tapestry, isn't it? That he was under duress and that he was tricked, because that was the allegation, was that Edmund was, you know, he was forced to effectively make this oath. So that, I mean, that might be the origins of the story, that he was forced to make the oath, that the relics were not, it wasn't actually opened up and shown him what saints it was that he had promised that he would hand this kingship over on, and until after he had actually promised it. So that, you know, that does say that there's truth to the Saxon story, basically, because you have a Saxon and a Norman story here. But again, it also shows you the importance of oaths. I mean, the whole of society was built and rested upon people keeping their oaths. If we go back to Alfred the Great, one of the worst things that it was that you could do is to break your oath, to break your oath to the king. I mean, it was equivalent of murder almost to break your oath. It was a really, really serious thing. And later on, when we get to Edward Longshanks, the reason why he went into Wales and took the princedom from Wales, and that's why we have the Prince of Wales, is the English king's first son, is because the Welshmen broke their oaths to him. That's why he went in there. It's the same reason why he went into Scotland, is because the Scots broke their oaths. This was taken as a very, very serious thing. And what we have today, well, people are mainly atheists and nobody really believes in God anymore. So people are making these oaths and it really doesn't mean anything. And people don't really seem to understand how important that is. If people lose their faith in God, then they can break their oaths. And yet everything, the whole of the public society, or the whole of the public sector, rather, is based upon people promising that they will carry out their duty, so help me God, expecting to be punished by God. And if they're not expecting to be punished by God, if they break their oaths, then that just leaves everything open to corruption. I mean, they used to actually promise that they would uphold the laws of the Bible and the morals of the Bible. And that effectively meant that Jews couldn't enter Parliament, and organised Jewry then lobbied Parliament in order to get those laws changed. And it took them, I think, two or three different parties in governance before they actually got the laws changed, so that instead of taking an oath on the Bible and swearing to uphold the laws of the Bible, you could take an oath on something else. And it effectively meant that people didn't have to swear to uphold the laws of the Bible any longer. And lo and behold, 120 years later, people don't obey the laws of the Bible. Jeff, do you want to make a comment on that?
Yes, there's two points I would like to make here. There's Edward I went into Scotland because he was chosen as the overlord to two claimants to the Scottish throne. One was Baliol and the other was Robert the Bruce. And he chose Baliol, but Robert the Bruce didn't accept it. So, you know, even though they probably sworn that they would do. So, and the other situation is with the Jews in the country, that they weren't allowed to enter Parliament until 1857 because they had to swear an oath saying on the oath of a Christian that they would be true to the constitution of the British nation. And they wouldn't accept that. So I think it was Lord Lionel Rothschild was the first Jew to enter Parliament and actually be given this dispensation to say not do that. So that they were the first people to enter Parliament without being Christians. So,
and then we go on from today, and you got Muslims in Parliament, we got Sikhs in Parliament, we got all different ones in there. And that's basically where it goes back to, and why they lobbied so that they could get it changed, because they didn't want to take an oath to a Christian God, which implied upholding Christian laws and Christian values. So I say, like 100 years later, we no longer have these. We no longer have these values. And you can see all of this goes back to this oath-taking that is the basis of civilization, really, is people keeping their promises, keeping their oaths, and believing that there would be a serious punishment if they did not keep their oath. So it was quite a serious thing that William believed that Harold had gone back on his oath, effectively. The tapestry represents a ship under sail, expressive of Harold's return. That's Harold returning back from France after he apparently took this oath. And afterwards, Harold making his report to Edward. So the allegation is that Edward knew about this, that Harold had taken this oath to support William's accession to the throne. The king's sickness and funeral follow. The next figures show Harold's coronation. One man offers him the king and another a battle axe. Beyond this, Harold appears on his throne with the globe and the cross in his left hand and a scepter in his right. On his right, two men are presenting to him a sword, and Stigand, the archbishop, is standing on his left. And I think Stigand, the archbishop, he wasn't recognised by the Church of Rome, actually. So this is another allegation that when this coronation took place, the archbishop was not actually recognised by the Bishop of Rome. On the evening of Edward's funeral, which was the day after his death, Harold possessed himself of the crown of England. As there were other pretenders to the dignity, of whom one at least, Edgar Etheling, the grandson of Edmund Ironside, was invested with the interesting right of hereditary descent, delay was perilous to the ambition of Harold. Hence, while the nobles were agitated with divided minds, Harold boldly decided the splendid question by availing himself of the support of his friends and by obtaining an instantaneous coronation from the suspended Archbishop of Canterbury. That Harold used his authority with kingly dignity and for the great ends of public utility is asserted and must be admitted with the qualification that as his reign was so short, the panegyric must be referred to its intentions rather than to his actions. It is, however, essential to a usurper to be popular, as human ingenuity cannot invent a spell more potent to arrest the favour of its contemporaries than the practice of virtue. All rulers whose right to power is ambiguous and whose possession of it depends on the public support will affect to govern a while, at least, with equity and popularity. The true character of Harold cannot therefore be judged from his actions in the emergency of competition, and he perished before the virtues of his disposition could be distinguished from those of his convenience. And I think actually we'll see as we go on through this that Harold did not actually rule as a good man. I mean, later on, we'll actually see that he didn't pay his soldiers and they left because he didn't pay them. He refused to pay them after they fought and won a battle, which, you know, that's not a good thing. That's going to rile people up against you. That's not going to encourage people to support you as being the king, especially if there is a if there is a question to it. And I do love the way that this is written. It's written, I think, about 1850, something like that. And the description is just perfect. I mean, you read stuff today and it's so basic and dumbed down. And yet this really uses these the vocabulary of the English language to get the point across. And I think he gets a really good point across. And it also comes across that the person writing this is a highly moral character. And he's talking about virtue and the practice of virtue. I mean, how many history writers today would be talking about the practice of virtue and of that being a very important thing? I mean, they would just be noting what happened at what time. They wouldn't be talking about how virtuous the actual ruler was and how well he was seen in the eyes of the people and what a good example that he set. I mean, today we're encouraged to think that it's a good thing if we have leaders that perhaps have criminal records because it shows that they're just like everybody else. Well, in days gone by, you didn't want somebody leading who was just like everybody else. You wanted somebody leading that could demonstrate kingly virtue and valour and fight in battle for us. I mean, how many of our leaders today would go on the front lines and fight in battle for us? You know, that's the last thing that they would do. Jeff, got any comments on this?
Yeah, it's very interesting what you're saying, Sven, because the situation is that we're actually talking about the character of Harold in that. You know, what is happening here? There's a power battle going on. There's a power battle between the forces in Anglo-Saxon England and Normandy. So there's other competitors to the throne. What does he do? You know, and that is an amazing thing to look at, isn't it? A lot of people sort of say about Richard III and his actions going for the crownship. But sometimes, perhaps if you don't get the crown, you get your head locked off. And that might be one of the things that actually devised in that you had to go for the crown. And that's what he did. And that's what it seems so. It'd be quite nice to actually have some information from him or somebody very close to him who actually sort of said what sort of the motivations governed him at this sort of time.
Yes, that's an important point. If you had other pretenders to the crown, there was always this risk that you were going to be executed. I mean, there was instances even with Canute, who was a great king, and he was accused of killing his own father, King Svein, and he got rid of two other princes and had them exiled, and I think somebody else had them murdered, and the accusation is that it was at Canute's hand. Again and again we hear of somebody becoming king, and then we hear that their relatives, they end up killing them or exiling them to prevent them from making their go at receiving the crown. It is amusing to remark how industrious the chroniclers of this period have been to record that a comet appeared this year in the heavens, and that it forebode the revolutions of greatness and the bloodshed which ensued. The popular impression produced by this comet is shown by its having been worked in the tapestry of Bayeux. This relic of ancient times contains, immediately after Harold's coronation, a rude figure of the comet, with several persons gazing at it with eager eyes and pointing hands. And I find this interesting because it reminds me of the prophecies of Merlin, which I think we talked about earlier in the series. And Merlin had all sorts of dreams, where he dreamed of things like greyhounds and dragons and a wild boar. And all of these figures were later on in history, they were shown to have presaged important events in British history. So I imagine that this comet that appeared, that was probably also talked about by Merlin. People don't realise that it's not just the Old Testament prophets that make all these prophecies that then were found to come true. But in Britain, there are all these prophecies as well. Things were seen as omens. I mean, at the time when I think it was the Druids or the monks that were in Anglesey, and before they were all butchered by the Saxons, there were omens in the sky before what happened to Boadicea and Boadicea's uprising. Again, there were omens that were seen in the sky before these great changes happened on Earth. And that's why this is being shown in this tapestry, because it was an omen of what was about to occur when they saw this comet in the sky. The enjoyment of a favourite felicity is seldom the consequence of its violent acquisition. Harold found his crown full of the thorns which poets and moralists have been fond of describing. Three competitors prepared at the same time to wrestle with him for it. Each was formidable enough to have endangered his prosperity, but the combination of their hostilities could have hardly failed to overpower him. The rivals of Harold were his brother Tostig, William Duke of Normandy, and Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway. The two last were sovereigns of long-established authority and great military experience, and came with peculiar advantage into a conflict with Harold, whose ancestry was obscure, whose power was young, whose title was questionable, and whose friends were but a party in the nation which he governed. Tostig was a man of talents and activity, but his fraternal relation gave to his hostilities a peculiar venom. He had been expelled from Northumbria in a preceding reign, and he had not been recalled by Harold. His discontent and envy were fostered by William, who embraced the policy of multiplying the enemies and of dividing the strength of Harold. Eager to oppress his more fortunate brother, Tostig attempted, but in vain, to excite the King of Denmark to attack him. On the mind of Harald Hardrada, King of Norway, he operated with more success. The Norwegian consented to invade England in the summer. And I'll just pause there before we get into some more of this, because this really does remind me of the sort of thing that we see today when we see people from Belarus calling for sanctions to be put on Belarus. You hear Alexei Navalny calling for sanctions to be put on Russia. I've heard various people claiming to be Persians or Iranians calling for more bombing of Iran. And there have always been these traitors to their country that have gone to other countries asking them to intervene and effectively to make them the overlords of the country, because it means that they themselves will then get a seat at the table. So I don't think this is something new. Jeff, any thoughts on that, on modern day traitors and the traitor that we see here, Tostig?
Well, that's very interesting what you're saying there, Sven, about Tostig. It is Harold's brother, so as it says, it must have been quite a ferocious sort of resentment that he must have had against his own brother, and that gave everything a particular venom, as the author has said. But this has happened throughout history. Now, Alcibiades, the Athenian, he was exiled by his political enemies, and he went to Sparta, and he worked out ways how to defeat Athens. But who is the patriot here? Who is the traitor here? This is what we got in this country with the political establishment. For example, in 1939, MI6, the Dizian Bureau and the Poles were operating in a campaign to terrorise Germany and Italy. This is at the same time when Chamberlain was talking about peace. Now, Chamberlain had actually signed off this operation. So, yeah, it's all fun, isn't it? All fun and games, isn't it? It's just a tremendous amount of chaos and trouble going on. And you think if you're in that, you could be on the top at one moment, and the next minute you could have your head chopped off the next.
Well, also, this is... this basically shows you that this Tostig character, because he didn't have a seat at the table, that was it. He was going to invite invaders to invade the country just for his own personal ambition. So things don't really change that much from today. Tostig went to Flanders to prepare the means of an aggression of his own. He visited William of Normandy, of whose ambition he was made a convenient instrument. He collected all the English who were willing to join him. He raised many supplies from Flanders and with 60 ships proceeded to the English coast. He levied contributions from the Isle of Wight and plundered along the shore till he reached Sandwich. So he's invaded his own country here and he's basically robbing and ripping off the people from his own country in preparation for people from another country to invade. Harold was then at London. He collected a very numerous fleet and army because he perceived that his brother's force was but the advanced guard of William. When Harold reached Sandwich, Tostig, whose friends were chiefly in the north, sailed hastily from Lincolnshire and committed many ravages on Lindsay. The earls of Mercia and Northumbria allowed him no time to collect support, but commenced an immediate opposition. Tostig, defeated by their energy, fled to Scotland with 12 ships to await the arrival of his allies, and Malcolm gave him an asylum. So he's found another traitor up there in Scotland, Malcolm. The first arrow of calamity was thus happily averted from Harold, but the feeblest arm of the Confederacy had thrown it, and the triumph did not much augment the security of the king. The two sovereigns, whose power singly was sufficient to endanger him, were now preparing a combined attack. I mean, this is a huge power play that's going on here. And in a way, I mean, you could say that it's this Tostig that's in large part sort of responsible for this, especially for getting the Norwegian king to go there as well. I mean, did the Norwegian king know the fact that William was also going there? I mean, because the Norwegian king, he had a claim on the throne as well. He had a claim to actually being king. So were they really working together, Harald Hardrada and William the Conqueror? I mean, it seems to me that Harald was trying to get there first to attack Harald Godwinson, and William was going to go there second, knowing that Harald Hardrada was also going there, and that he would wear down Harald Godwinson first before William arrived. And then you've got this Tostig who's basically just going around trying to get whoever he can to invade the country, and he's also managed to find other traitors in Flanders to join him. I mean, that I don't think very much of that. He's able to get his ships, 12 ships or whatever, with 600 men or however many men it was that he managed to find in Flanders, and they were basically going to Britain to rob, rape and pillage effectively their own people. Not very impressive. Jeff, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's quite interesting what you're saying there, Sven. What it is happening here is that Tostig's going around and he's talking to the Norwegian king. He's fled to Scotland, where Malcolm, the King of Scotland, has taken him in. He's got information from the Duke of Normandy. Was it a coordinated campaign? It could well be in the Wars of the Roses. They used to set up diversions from London. The army would come from London to deal with uprisings in Wales or Lincolnshire or Northumberland, and then they would attack from a different direction. Yeah, so we should not underestimate the people of the past. There was the same sort of minds as us and the same thoughts and aspirations. And what it seems to be quite interesting is, why are these people so eager to become king And the dangers involved are just absolutely enormous, aren't they?
Yeah, yes, they wanted this great power. I know it's it is relevant to this, but I recently saw an anime called the Vinland Saga, and it was all about the early life of Canute, and it had Welsh people in it, and there was a Welsh guy that was secretly Welsh, and he was actually sired by somebody Danish, and he was from the line of King Arthur. And this is something we talked about. It's alternative history, so I was very surprised to actually see it on anime being portrayed as you know, this is the actual history. It was very, very well done series, and in that it talks about the different ways that a king is from normal people, from mortal men, basically. I mean, it really is in his power who lives and who dies, and he may have to pick that people may have to die for the good of the country, for the good of the group. And as Canute was trying to build a utopia, but along the way to that utopia, he had to kill lots of people. And that's not the sort of thing that the average public man thinks about, is that he has the power to keep somebody alive or to kill them. For instance, the king needs more supplies for his army in England to make sure that England remains a realm of his. But he doesn't want to get that money from the English, because that would turn them against him. So he has to get that money from the Danes, basically. And he goes after this really good farmer. And he knows that he's a really good farmer and he's a really good man. But in the greater scheme of things, he has to take this money from the Danes in order to keep the English and have this larger empire. So that is just an example of the things that a king may have to do. I mean, it was a very good investigation of what it is to be a monarch and the difference between the monarch and your average private citizen or commoner. So I guess people would look at it and they would want that power, they would want the wealth, but once they actually had that wealth, once they actually had the crown on their head, they realized that they had all the woes that come with that and all the responsibility that comes with that, being responsible for the lives of everybody there, and then using those lives to try and improve the kingdom, enlarge the kingdom. And it says in the Old Testament that if a king is put over the Israelites, he will enlarge his horses, and he will put their men to fight in wars, and he will tax them, and all these various things, that negative things to do with the king. You have positive side of it, that you have this focal point of the nation that you can approach. You have a direct line to the king. The king can have a direct line to the people on the bottom there. So what the king says goes. He owns everything, but which is all a good thing, I guess. But then you've got the negative side to it as well, that the king is going to want to enlarge his territory, and it's the lives of your fathers and your brothers and your sons that are going to end up feeding this machine. Yet people still did want to be king, as we see here. And in fact, they just wanted a seat at the table. That's all this Tostig wanted, was a seat at the table. William, the rival of Harold, was the son of Robert, the fifth Duke of Normandy. He was not a legitimate child, but in these days, this circumstance, though always a reproach, did not prevent deserving talents from attaining the royal succession. So it's saying, because he was such a successful man, because he was such an alpha male, that's really why he attained this royal succession, because there was this excuse there that could have prevented him, the fact that he was a bastard, as it says here. William, like our Athelstan and Edmund Ironside, was admitted to assume the dignity of his father. When Robert, obeying a fashion of his day, went to Jerusalem with a noble retinue, he appointed his boy, William, though but a child, to govern Normandy in his stead, under the superintendence of a wise and faithful administration, and he engaged his nobles and the King of France to guard his arrangement. Robert died at Nice on his return from Palestine in 1035, the same year in which Canute the Great departed from this scene of his existence. William, at the age of 8, became the Duke of Normandy. His minority tempted many nobles to rebel against him and to be turbulent towards each other. The King of France also coveted his dominions. Normandy was for many years harassed by wars, murders, and civil feuds. And William, like Philip of Macedon, experienced adversity enough to excite his energies and to discipline his judgment. The abilities of his friends at first and afterwards his own good conduct surmounted every difficulty. He not only secured his own power, but having so often measured it against others with success, he was taught to know its strength, to nurture ambition upon that knowledge, and to look around him for new theatres on which his active mind could be employed with profit, and where increased celebrity would reward its exertions. The friendship of Edward, the visit of Harold, and the state of the English court excited and determined him to aim at the sceptre of our island. The sudden coronation of Harold prevented the effect of any private intrigues, and left to William no hope but from his sword. William, however, knew that the combat was half gained if the moral impressions of society were in his favour, and he therefore sent an embassy to Harold, gently expostulating upon the seizure of the crown, reminding him of the sworn compact, and announcing hostilities if he persisted in the violation. After Harold's coronation, such messages could be only a theatrical trick played off by the Norman to call the attention of the people to the moral circumstances of the case, to introduce the claims of William publicly to their notice, to encourage his partisans, and to assume the merit of peaceful discussion. William could never have supposed that upon a mere message, Harold could have walked down humbly from the throne, which he had been so hasty to ascend. Harold acted his part in the diplomatic farce and gave a popular answer. His topics were as well selected as the case afforded. An oath extorted by violence could not be binding on the conscience. Human laws admitted a maiden's vow to be annulled, which was made without her parents' consent, as void must be the promise of an envoy pledged without his master's knowledge. Besides, how could any individual claim the right of royal succession without the national consent? And how could he abandon voluntarily a dignity with which the favour of the most potent nobles of England had honoured him? By wedding Alditha, the daughter of Earl Algar, instead of Adeliza, the daughter of William, Harold strengthened himself at home, because Mercia and Northumbria were governed by the brothers of the lady. So this is interesting as well. So it's quite clear that this must have happened, this oath must have happened, because it's referred to here, and it's referred to of him breaking his oath, and then the response is, well, the oath was extorted by violence. And perhaps that could just mean that he didn't know what saints it was that he was making his oath upon. And I mean, really, you could say, well, you should have asked, shouldn't you? Asked what saints it was that you were taking this oath upon, of how important it was that you actually kept this oath. Also, it shows you that William isn't just going in there with military might. He wants to have the backing of the public with him. He wants the public to see that it's a moral cause, and that Harold Godwinson has wrongfully taken this crown after originally promising that he would help William. And William's only claim to it is because he alleges that Edmund had promised that he would have the crown upon his death. So you can see there's a bit of a sort of a moral quandary here. And who are the English going to support? But it seems that the English supported Harold Godwinson more than William, although the English that were on the continent in Flanders had gone off with Tostig to try and put William on the throne. So I do think that the country was probably split as to who they would actually support. And in reality, the majority of people probably didn't care who it was, just so long as we had a king and that he didn't extort taxes from them too much. They probably weren't bothered which one it was. I mean, what people don't really understand today, I guess, is that Europeans were all Europeans. And with the royal family, it doesn't have to be somebody from your people group that's ruling over you. Prince Edward, the Iron Duke, the Duke of Edinburgh? I mean, he was Greek. He was a Greek prince. Queen Elizabeth's family, they were German. I think they were Battenbergs. They were German. We had the brother of the King of England was the Tsar of Russia. So as far as royalty were concerned, they didn't actually have to be from the nation that they were ruling. What was important is that you had a king, you had a focal point, and that he was a moral person. So William is trying to show that he is a moral person here. He has the upper morality because Harold Godwinson broke his oath. And Harold Godwinson's return to that was, well, you wouldn't expect a woman to keep her oath. Why would you expect this envoy to keep his oath, which was under duress because he didn't know which saints it was. But the fact that he doesn't say there, well, we don't believe you that Edmund said that you could have the kingship, really sort of does imply that Edmund did actually say that he would rather that it went to him, because he had no issue of his own. So he had to find somebody to bequeath the kingdom to. Jeff, any thoughts on this?
And we're seeing this all the time nowadays, aren't they? People jockeying for position, doing various sorts of things like that. You know, the other day, the film Spartacus that was on, where the Roman general Crassus, he actually bribes the Silesian pirates not to take away the slave army. And he bribes them so he can get a victory. And that, because he gets a victory, that enables him to attack his enemies in Rome. But it could have been that I will let the slaves all go. But no, he decided that he needed a victory. He needed to bribe the pirates not to take him away. And eventually he slaughtered all the slave rebellion. And this is what's going on here, isn't it? It's a tactic which has been going on throughout history. Strategy, you know, moral superiority is another one, isn't it? Like saying that, well, he swore an oath. But when you think about it, how valid was this?
Yeah, it's a point. So you got 2 points there, haven't you? You've got his William's military prestige, and what a great fighter he is, or what a great king he is. And then you've also got the fact that he's morally superior, or he's alleging the moral superiority. So that was important to them, that they were seen as being moral in their actions. William held counsel with his chiefs on his project of invasion. Some thought the chance unfavourable to Normandy and dissuaded it. The influence of the Duke surmounted opposition, and preparations were vigorously made. A great number of ships were immediately constructed. The tapestry, after the representation of a ship arriving from England, shows William on his throne, with the inscription, "Here Duke William gave orders to build ships." Men cutting down trees with axes and planing them into planks, others arranging and hammering these into vessels, are the next figures. Afterwards, 5 men appear pulling ships after them by ropes. Above are these words, "Here they drew the ships to the sea." And I find this interesting as well. I mean, today we're used to having a battle fleet, and we have a fleet of ships, and we have a navy. But it looks like he didn't have a navy, he didn't have a ship. So, I mean, he had to build the ships from scratch before he could make his way over to Britain. And that's just something that I hadn't thought of before, that you would actually have to build the ships, large enough ships, to get your force over there. I sort of assumed that they would already have ships, but I guess they would be being used for something else, and he wouldn't be able to commandeer them. Any thoughts on the fact that they had to build their own ships to do this and didn't have any there before, Jeff?
Oh, I think the situation is here, you have to remember, having a fleet for naval defence is much different than having an invasion fleet. Because the invasion fleet will have to carry all the Norman troops across, plus their horses, which is a very important part of the Norman army, and then all the other sort of things. And it says wine and arms. So you've got the armour, you've got the supplies, you've got everything. So an invasion fleet would be much bigger than a sort of just normal coastal defence sort of fleet. So, yeah, it's just amazing how the Bay of Tapestry actually brings it out and actually makes it quite clear that he had to have enormous preparation to do this. And I presume that Harold had spies in Normandy, and they were being fully informing him of what was going to happen.
Yeah, it does seem they had they certainly had spies there. And it almost seems to me like it's like a cartoon that's on tapestry. It's on clothwork, basically. I mean, that's what it is. It's got the images, and then it's got the words describing what's going on. It's like an early example of one of the first comics, the Bayeux Tapestry. Or men carrying coats of mail, spears, swords, and wine, and two others dragging a car laden with weapons and a barrel are then exhibited. The inscription tells us these carry arms to the ships, and here they draw a car with wine and arms. Such was the expedition of the workmen that they were ready by the end of August. While the means of conveyance were providing, William was active in assembling soldiers sufficient for his attempt. His purpose was diffused through every land, and the courageous adventurer was invited from every coast to share in the honour, the danger, and the booty of the conflict. Crowds of fighters came from all parts adjacent. He collected powerful supplies from Brittany, France, Flanders, and their vicinity, which, joined with the soldiers whom he raised in his own Normandy, presented a massive force, not less formidable from their spirit of enterprise and their enthusiasm than from their numbers and the military skill of William, who had been accustomed to warfare from his infancy. The emperor so far favoured the expedition as to promise to protect Normandy against any enemies who might invade it in the Duke's absence. William was here also peculiarly fortunate. The King of France, though so much interested in preventing the Duke of Normandy from acquiring the additional power of the English crown, yet did not interfere to prevent the collection and departure of the expedition. Perhaps he judged it to be a desperate effort and waited to profit by its failure. William availed himself of the oaths which Harold had broken to give to his cause the appearance of religious sanctity. He therefore consulted with the Pope, who sent him a consecrated banner. And also bear in mind, one of the things that William did when he first took the Dukedom of Normandy, he replaced all the clergy with his own men. And that was one of the first things he did when he got to England as well, once he was made king, was to replace all the clergy with his own men. And also, you've got here, he's consulting with the Pope, and the Pope is giving him his sanction to go and do this. And this is 1066. And I think it's about 6 years after the schism. There was a great schism in the church. And at the end of the schism, you had the Roman Catholic Church on one side, and you had the Eastern Orthodox Church on the other side. And up until this point, I think, in Britain, the court of jurisdiction, the court that decided on religious matters, was in Constantinople. It wasn't actually in Rome, it was in Constantinople. So England of the time before the Norman are known as Anglo-Orthodox, and Alfred the Great is a saint in the Orthodox Church. So you had this split in the church in 1060, and then in 1066 you have the Pope, who sanctifies this mission and sends William on this mission. And then when William actually gets to England, he replaces the clergy that are in England with his own men, and England then becomes Roman Catholic rather than Anglo-Orthodox. So there was also this religious change here. And it wasn't just the fact that, the Pope had authorised this and said that it was okay. It was the fact that straight after that, then England became Roman Catholic, which I don't think is really talked about in mainstream sources. But you can see at the time of the schism was 1060. The invasion was 1066. The clergy were all changed from the Anglo-Saxon clergy to Norman clergy. And then Britain became Roman Catholic. So I don't think that is all a coincidence, that this is all happening at that time. So the fact that William was coming to England, I think it benefited the Pope for that reason. And I think the Pope saw that what they could do was ensure that England then became Roman Catholic rather than becoming Eastern Orthodox, which was sort of closer to where they were up until this point. It also shows you how important religion was, how important it was to replace the clergy with your own men, because otherwise it could have been a risk that the clergy could have been preaching against William. They could have been saying, oh, well, he got his oaths under duress and he's not the rightful king. So it was very important that they replaced him. And also don't forget that Harold Godwinson, he had also been crowned king by somebody that was excommunicated by the Pope. It was an archbishop that the Pope had just sort of kicked out from the church. So it was a rebel that had actually crowned him king anyway. So this is another side to it that people don't really think about is the religious side to this. Any comments on that, Jeff?
Yes, there's many times throughout history where things have turned out because the king didn't like the Pope, and they actually broke away from the Catholic Church, but they didn't actually become non-Catholics. And then the king would be in favour with the Pope again, and everything would be all right until another upset. And obviously, Henry VIII, if you think about him, they said he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, and he had to break with the Church of Rome. But if Henry VIII hadn't been king and his elder brother would have been king, he would have been called Arthur. And most people forget this. And what direction would England have gone in then? So there's so many sort of changes going on with religious importance. And it is very important for William at this point to get the backing of the religious leaders. The other thing was with religion at this time, it was only the clergy that were virtually educated. Most people couldn't read or write. So that is a very important group to get on your side.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is the reason why we had all these icons and these images, so that, and even this bio tapestry, so people that couldn't read and write could see what had actually happened. The other day, I went to have a look at the cathedral. I think you were there with us, Jeff, actually. When we had a look at that the cathedral there in Hereford, and you looked at the library there, they had these massive cases of books, and these archbishops would carry them around with them, a huge sort of 4 foot long by 3 foot high chest that would have these books in it, and they would be travelling along in a cart, in a horse-drawn cart, along with the bishop, as you say, because he was the only one that was able to read, and they would have all this knowledge there. It amazes me to think that today we have all that knowledge just in a little box in our hand, and everyone has it. Everybody can read and write pretty much, whereas in the past it was only the bishops. It was only them that actually had access to this knowledge. So, I mean, that was another reason why it was important to get them on board. Do you want to say something there, Jeff?
Yeah, well, that's very important. The situation with if you go back to 1775 and you've got the rebellion taking place in America, and so a gang of sort of leftist sort of people sort of attacked British troops in Boston, and they fired back in self-defense. And what happened to those people, those soldiers? They pleaded benefit of clergy, which meant they could read and write. And because they pleaded this, they were branded on the hand, which was only a smaller sort of offence than they would have been given. So even though after hundreds of years after this point, we're talking about in 1066, it was important that you could read or write.
So they were seen as value to the state, too valuable to be executed then, because they could read and write. They were useful people to the state. So they just branded them instead. I guess that's the reason for that there. While William was putting in action every means of offensive aggression, which talents like his, so exercised in warfare, could devise, the King of Norway was also summoning all the resources of his country to give prosperity to his ambitious hopes. It is a pleasing instance of the growing importance of England that his notice to his subjects of his intended expedition did not meet with the unanimous concurrence of the Norwegian mountaineers, though some, exulting in the recollection of then Harald's achievements, thought disaster impossible. Yet others intimated that England abounded with valiant chiefs and soldiers. Like a part of the Norman nobility, they did not hesitate to foretell that the invasion would be a work of perilous difficulty and doubtful issue. a time had been when to mention an expedition against England was to collect speedily a numerous fleet of eager adventurers. But now that experience had made known the bravery of the natives. As the hour of attack drew near, ominous dreams began to fly through Norway. Snorre has detailed three of these and mentions that many other portents occurred of dire and foreboding import. The dark minds of the north discovered their feelings by their superstitions. They began to dread the English power, and they found deterring omens because they were disposed to look for them. Harald Hardrada, having appointed his son Magnus to govern Norway in his absence, sailed with his other son Olaf and with his queen Elizabeth and her daughters Maria and Engegerda across the British Ocean. He reached Shetland, and after a short delay he sailed to the Orkneys. He left there his family, and directing his course along Scotland, he landed with his multitude of warriors at the Tyne. His aggression seems to have been unforeseen. The Duke of Normandy absorbed the attention of Harald, who did not expect that his hour of difficulty would have been made more stormy by a competitor from the north. Hardrada found no opposition of importance on the English coasts. Tostig joined him. They sailed onwards to Scarborough, which they plundered and burnt. They turned the point of Holderness, and with above 500 ships, entered the Humber. They proceeded up the Ouse as far as York, as Richale. The related earls Edwin and Morcar, though taken unawares, prepared to oppose Harald Hardrada with the same spirit which had before expelled Tostig. On the 20th of September, they gave battle to the invaders near York, on the right side of the Ouse. Hardrada formed his warriors into such an arrangement that one of his wings reached to the river, and the other was flanked by a ditch and marsh full of water. The banner of the king and the flower of his warriors were on the river. His line at the ditch was weak, and tempted the attack of the earls, the brothers-in-law of Harald. They drove the enemy from their position. It was then that Hardrada rushed into the battle, and with his compact troops pierced through and divided the pursuing English. Some were driven to the river, some to the marsh and the ditch. The slaughter was so great that the Norwegians traversed the marsh on the bodies of the fallen Saxon. The Saxon account confirms the Icelandic. It claims the first advantage of the English, and acknowledges that in the disastrous close, more were pushed into the waters than were slain by the sword. The earls were besieged in York. So it seems that at first the English were winning, and then at the end of it, the English were losing. And I do find it interesting that Harald Hardrada brings his family over basically and leaves them in Scotland. I mean, he's thinking that he's going to be crowned as the king of England, and he have his whole family there. I mean, I would have thought that was particularly risky, bringing your wife and your children along with you on route to battle as this is. And it also shows you that up there in the Orkneys and at the top of Scotland, that must have been seen as part of the Norwegian Empire, I guess, rather than being a part of Britain, the United Kingdom, which we didn't have the United Kingdom at the time. So that the Orkneys were probably seen as actually belonging to Norway at the time. I mean, I'm not certain of that. I'm just making a guess there. Jeff, any thoughts on this?
Right, a long time the Shetlands and the Orkneys were a part of Norway. It all depends when you look at sort of British history and you look at how the Vikings sort of happened to sort of develop and attack the British Isles. You know, there's actually colonies of Vikings in Ireland, in Cork and Dublin. As you said about the Orkney Isles and the Shetland Isles, there were actually Norwegian possessions at one time. Well, what is the other thing that's interesting, what you said here, was that they put great store on omens, didn't they, and collecting all omens. And I remember that the Athenians, they launched an expedition against Sicily, because Sicily was back in Sparta. And they was over there, and they was thinking about retreating. And then there was a change in the moon. And they thought this was a bad sort of omen, so they didn't retreat. And eventually they all got annihilated. They ended up in the sort of the pits, digging out metals and stuff like that. But they then pointed out that the omen had been interpreted wrongly, and that the change of the moon was actually a good sign for a retreat. So they're doing the same thing again, aren't they? They're looking for omens to actually confirm the attack. And it seems like the Norwegians were expecting to win because of their historical sort of advantage. But there's a lot of people said, well, no, the Saxons are pretty sort of tough sort of people. It's not going to be an easy sort of walkover as such.
Yeah, the Saxons had quite a reputation there by that time. You had Alfred the Great, and I mean, he kicked the Danes, put them up north, didn't he, and tried to unite the country, really. I mean, I think it was after him, or a couple of generations after him, that the country was finally united. And you had Canute and his empire, the North Sea Empire, and the Saxons were under him for a while. And the Saxons fought on both sides. They fought on the side of the Danes as well as on the side of their Saxons. So they must have had quite a reputation by this time if the people in Norway were worried about going there. It seems that they had people that wanted to go there that were just keen to get the booty and the winnings and the prestige. And then there was a lot of people that were talking against it and saying this really isn't such a sensible thing to do. Well, I think we'll leave that there for now, Jeff, and we'll continue with that in 2 weeks' time. This is going to be bi-weekly, every other Friday. On the other Fridays, you'll have myself and Sam Melia doing our Thought Criminals podcast. And then on the next Friday, it will be the Patriotic History podcast with myself and Jeff Roberts. So thank you very much for coming on today, Jeff. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with more Patriotic History for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.